Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium.
Good evening. Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium for Thursday, July 10th, 2014. This is Michael Norris, and I'm joined by one of my co-hosts so far this evening, Jay West. Jerry's not going to be with us. I'll tell you why about that in just a minute, and I'm waiting for Bobby to call in. He got stuck at work, and we just finished wolfing down hot dogs, so he should be with us here in a minute. How you doing this evening, Jay?
I'm doing pretty good. Had a little back surgery last week, minor stuff, and back's feeling a lot better. And the weather's good, and my air conditioning's working, so I'm a happy guy. Might just be the Mike and Jay show here for a little while.
Bobby will be on with us here in just a second.
I'm sure he will. So you're eating hot dogs, huh?
Yeah. He's got me hooked on those Hebrew National hot dogs.
So we had some last week for July 4th. They were they're good for a change. I hadn't had some in a while, and we had those, and they were good. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing great. While we're waiting on him, why don't we go ahead and get our sponsor's ad out of the way real quick, and then
we'll do that. I had some notes I was looking over, and it got close to airtime here, and I said, "Uh-oh, where's my commercial?" And it's kind of like one of those radio guy nightmares where you have a dream and nothing works. You hit the turntable. This is really going back, talking about turntables. But, you know, you hit the thing, nothing happens. You hit the cart machine, nothing happens. And all of a sudden, you know, you turn the mic on, and what are you supposed to do? Because, you know, you pre-plan everything you do. So it's a real nightmare. But anyway, I found it. So here we go. Tonight's sponsor is Audible.com. A leading provider of spoken audio entertainment and information. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you go and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/GWHradio.
Very good.
Okay, hopefully the check's in the mail. I know what you wanted to talk about last week, but, I mean, last time we were on, you asked a question about Dusty Rhodes and whether Dirty Dusty Rhodes ever appeared in Georgia before he made his face turn and basically never worked as a heel again. And I told you I thought he did, so I did a little research. And if you don't mind, if you got a minute here, well, let's do this. From the Ringsider, this is 10 May 1974, this was an Omni card, and it mentions that promoter Paul Jones will have world champion Jack Briscoe defending his title next week at the Omni. That would have been on May 17th. Also appearing on that card, Andre the Giant, Haystacks Calhoun, the Great Malenko, and Dusty Rhodes. Man, that was, just looking at those names right then brings back a lot of memories, and what a card. You know, that just to think about that, the fans today just have no idea as to what a show like that was all about. That show had a Southeastern title match. Now, the Southeastern title as such, to my knowledge, had never been used in Atlanta. And I think it was the title that was used in either Macon or Columbus. Jerry could probably.
Yeah, I think they were used in Fred's Towns. I know they had a Southeastern Tag Team title too, I believe.
Right, and Bobby Duncombe had the belt, And anyway, he put up the belt against Jerry Briscoe that night, and Briscoe won. And starting with the next week, Briscoe's Jerry's name was listed in the champion section of the ringsider, who had never shown that belt before. But it was, you know, I could tell it was legit because there was actually a belt. World title match on that card, Jack Briscoe, champion, versus world title claimant Dusty Rhodes. And to my knowledge, that was the first appearance of Dusty in Atlanta. And that was an Omni card. And that was followed up by a Southeastern Heavyweight Championship match, Jerry Briscoe, champion, versus Dusty Rhodes. That was on the 24th of May. And the main event was a world title match, Mass versus Title, Jack Briscoe versus Wrestling 2. And then that led up because I remember that night Jerry and Dusty got into it. Jerry Briscoe versus Pat Patterson on the next card. Patterson came in. He, you know, did not work here on any kind of regular basis. He was listed as the West Coast champion against Jerry Briscoe, Southern States champion. And, of course, Patterson did not win that night. But the championship match, this was the buildup, was Jack Briscoe champion versus Dusty Rhodes challenger, World Heavyweight Championship, no DQ, special guest referee Stu Schwartz, NWA troubleshooter, who, of course, was one of the primary refs in Florida at that time.
Right.
And then the main event was Andre the Giant versus Cowboy Bill Watts in an 18-foot high steel cage match with special guest referee, former world champion Pat O'Connor. So at that time, the Omni cards were really loaded affairs. But to my knowledge, that was the first three or four appearances by Dusty in the Atlanta area. He was a heel all of those, and then he left. And I don't think he came back until whatever time he, you know, became a babyface in Florida. And then he was, anytime he came in here after that, he was a crowd favorite. And, you know, that was my little bit of research there.
That's about a month or so before he made the babyface turn, because I want to say that happened in June of 74.
Right, so that, you know, that led right into that.
You know, it's funny, that stacked card like that. Hold on, let me get Bobby on with us. All right, Bobby's with us now. That's funny, that stacked card in May of 74, because they really weren't getting much competition at that point from All
Stars. That's true.
Because All Stars was slowly sliding down the hill at that point, and I'm surprised that they stacked, you know, unless, when did they open the Omni? Maybe that was, the Omni was still new enough, they were still stacking the cards.
Omni opened in 72.
72, so it had already been open in 2 years.
I think they were just trying to drive the nails into the coffin there for All South. But, I mean, unbelievable card. I mean, just think about it. Andre the Giant, Haystacks Calhoun, the Great Malenko, and Dusty Rhodes, and none of those guys, you know, were guys that worked the area and, you know, on a regular basis.
Did Malenko ever work here?
Huh?
Did Malenko ever work here in Georgia?
Not to my knowledge. How about you, Bobby?
No, I don't ever remember him being here.
And they've got a picture of Rhodes there with, it looks like, the North American heavyweight title belt on, which would have been, you know, from Oklahoma. And I don't think this is an AWA belt he's got
on.
Well,
actually, in 74, Watts left McGurk and went to Florida.
Yeah.
And he carried the North American belt with him in 74. I think it was switched around between Watts, Bill Armstrong, Bob Armstrong, and Buddy Colt.
Correct.
They switched it around in Florida quite a bit. And Dusty did have that same belt when he was in Oklahoma.
Right.
A year or two prior to that, because I've got pictures of him with that belt. So.
Right. Yeah. This is a picture of Dusty with a, you know, very short haircut before he went with the.
Yeah. So that, yeah, definitely him. Yeah.
With the long. So, you know, that's an older picture of Dusty. And I don't think the fans really, you know, knew much about Dusty at that time. And they accepted him quite easily as a heel when he came in initially.
Yeah.
So, at any rate, that's when that was. And as you said, you know, that I think it was just, you know, as you said, it was towards the end of the All South time there, and they were just relatively still, the Omni was new and trying to be established, and just putting together something that the fans definitely couldn't turn down, and it was just one big show after another.
We only ran the Omni one time with All South.
Really?
But I don't remember when it was, but we only ran it one time. And it was in 74. So I don't know if that was sometime around the time we were going to run our show there or not.
Could be. Could be. How big a draw was Andre when he would come in here?
Well, initially I'd say he was an exceptionally big draw. He was on the cover of the magazines. The WWF was getting a lot of coverage, and fans knew him, and they wanted to see him. And some guys, you see him once, like Haystacks, and then you don't want to see him again for a while. But he would draw again later. But I as long as they keep putting Andre up against different guys like Watts and whoever. And you always felt like there was a chance Andre, somebody might be able to pick him up, because that was the big challenge. Fans would want to come see that, but he was always the face when he was in here during that time. But he was a big draw, in my opinion.
Yeah, because he came to Mobile about that same time in '74 for the first time, and. He only came to Gulf Coast Territory three times, twice in Mobile and once in Dothan. And Dusty, the one and only time he ever worked the Gulf Coast Territory was a card in Dothan, a world title match between he and Terry Funk when Terry Funk was world champion. I take it back. He came one more time to Dothan, and he teamed with somebody in a tag team match. I don't remember who his partner was or who the opponents were. I'll have to dig around and find that. But anyway, what I wanted to do this week is finish up the final 2 years of the Hall of Fame, look back at the Hall of Fames that you guys had started with Rich when I was incapacitated. And these are actually easy because these are all names that we're all familiar with. And you two guys probably were around, and Bobby, I'm sure, refereed a lot of their matches. Some of them not, some of them he would have. The first group, we're going to look at 2012 first, that year's inductees. The first is, as a group, the Armstrong family, Bob, Brad, Scott, and Steve.
Who?
The James Gang.
Yeah. The only two I ever, I worked with Bob, of course, I don't know how many times. Worked with Brad quite a bit. Had the privilege of working in a ring with Scott once, maybe. And that was, never had a chance to work with Steve. But what a pleasure. I mean, here's two guys that are a family, really, all of them as far as I know. They were going to show up. They were going to be on time. They were going to do whatever you ask. And all my years of being around Bob, the only time he ever had a problem with anybody that I know of as far as working was Don Jardine, because Jardine tried to bully people around. Of course, he tried to bully the wrong one, and Bob stood up to him, and it wound up being a big meeting in the office and the whole bit. But, once that was behind them, they had some great matches together. But, yeah, Bob never had a problem with doing anything. And, of course, Brad, geez, I mean, it's just hard to believe he's gone. Probably in the best shape of his life after he got out of the business full-time and just left us way too soon. But the whole family... great to be around and a pleasure to be with, and had the privilege of making a lot of trips with Bob, and can't say enough good things about him.
Well, my remembrances are similar to Bobby's. You know, Bob was one of the first guys of the late '60s era. You know, getting away from a couple of the guys we're going to look at here later on, Buddy Fuller and Ray Gockel, but of the next era there, Bob was one of the first guys I remembered. And of course, initially he was introduced as the wrestling fireman, and I always thought he did a great job in the ring, and he got over real well. And he did that Southern type of interview that with a little bit of the rhyming in it that folks really went for, and they considered him a hometown guy. First match that I ever ring announced, before I actually went to work for anybody, I was working at the radio station in Marl, WSSA, and the Kiwanis had a show there at the one of the little centers there in Forest Park, and yeah, I was familiar with wrestling, and they didn't have an announcer for it. And Eddie Smith worked that card. It's the only time I ever worked with Eddie Smith. And Bob was in the main event that night, so I have a remembrance of that. And also prior to that, in 1971, when I was living in Albany, Georgia, Bob was in the first live card, him and Bill Dromo against the Assassins down in Albany, when I went to a show down there. So I remember Bob over the long haul, and you know, one of the things that I remember was the accident that he had with the weights, and that situation when the weight bench fell, and he injured himself very severely, and it was great that he was able to come back from that. And the bullet identity, I think, kind of came from having the facial scars that he had for a while. So, you know, it was always a pleasure to see him do an interview, do what he did in the ring. Of course, he was one of the first guys to get a major push because of the All-South split, because he stayed around here. And three of the first big main events they had at the Atlanta City Auditorium on Friday night were Bob against Buddy Colt, who they brought in from Florida. And those were real bloodbaths, and each one would build up to something else. And, you know, as a fan, that was really main events that, as Gordon would say, you could see anywhere in the world. You know, they were great. Him and Colt worked very well together. I remember Brad when he first started, and, you know, he was the father's son, and he had a lot of his dad's moves, and he was a small guy. But he was built well, and he was great. I knew very little about Scott or Steve. I never worked or introduced either one of them or Brian later on. But I saw pictures of what they did, and it's very unusual to see a family of that many, you know, legit family members to actually work together. And the Armstrongs are, in my opinion, a legacy as a wrestling family, and something that Southern wrestling fans and people in the business can really be proud of.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I had only known about Bob Armstrong from reading about him in magazines and everything, and the first time I actually saw him was a Northeast. He was in Tampa. He'd never been in Tampa before. He was there. He was getting a shot at the North American title, which was held by Buddy Colt at that time.
That's right.
Colt had beaten Watts for it. And I went with a friend of mine who was a longtime wrestling fan in Tampa. And, you know, Tampa back in those days, whenever you came through the door, they handed you a little program, a little sheet of paper with that night's card on it. And so he was going down there looking through it and everything, and he said, "Who's this guy getting a title shot named Bob Armstrong? I've never heard of him before." And I decided to clue him in because, you know, I'd read about Armstrong. I'd never seen him work, but I'd read about him and knew how good he was and everything, or how good he was portrayed to be. And I said, "Well, I'll tell you what." I said, "Colt will lose that title tonight because Bob Armstrong is going to take it from him." And we kind of put a little friendly wager on it, and sure enough, Bob won it that night.
That's right.
But that was the first time I had seen him live, and he was electric. I mean, anybody that ever saw Bob work from, you know, back when you first saw him in the late 60s, Jay, all the way up to the mid-80s, he was lightning fast with his hands and his feet. even though you're blind as a fan, but you didn't know that as a fan at that time. And, you know, he did his karate stuff that he, you know, supposedly had learned in the Marines and all that stuff and everything, and he was tremendous. I later had the pleasure of working for him because when I, the short time I spent with Fuller during the three-week run that I, full-time run that I had with him, Bob was the booker there. Brad was there as well, but they were playing him up as a that he'd been injured by Randy Rose and Dennis Condrey, but Brad was around. And the thing that struck me about Brad, Brad and I were about the same age, and he called me sir. He called everybody sir. I'm like, Brad, come on. But I happened to see, I saw Brad's very first match. It was July 4th of either 79 or 80. It was one of those years. It was July 4th in Mobile, and I can't tell you who he worked with, but he won the first match that he ever had, and he was green as a gourd, but you could tell, you know, like you said, he had a lot of Bob's mannerisms, but at the same time, he was a carbon copy of Bob.
Right.
And then at that time, Scott was still, I think he was, I'll throw a name out of the ancient Atlanta past, he was a bank teller with First Atlanta Bank here in Atlanta. He hadn't gotten in the business yet, and Steve was either a junior or senior at Gulf Breeze High School in Gulf Breeze, Florida, and he was a pitcher. Because one night Bob came in, and he was beaming, and he was proud as he could be. Steve had pitched a no-hitter that week, pitching for Gulf Breeze, so he was proud of him. But I think Steve, now Brian may be heavier when he got in the business, but Steve was tall. See, he was taller than the rest of them. Steve was like 6'4", 6'3", 6'4", and a lot bulkier. But they turned out to all be very good workers. And just like Bobby said, they're just the ones, Brad and Bob, like I said, I never was around Scott or Steve, but they were. I could imagine they were all raised the same way, very polite, just great. Great people, and just what a loving family.
Right, that's where that sir thing came from,
yep.
You know, and it's very, very, you know, common among Southerners. I call people sir and ma'am. They look at me kind of funny sometimes, you know, but that's the way I was raised. I hadn't seen Bob in many years until last year when we were all together for the Nightmare to Remember 3. And the last one to take place, and I was very happy to be in the ring that night when Bob received the award for Brad, and that was a very, very touching night, and, you know, it had been many years since I'd been in a ring, and I was very happy to be involved in that.
I'll give you two or three real quick Bob Armstrong stories, just little incidents that happened over the years. You were talking about the karate stuff. He was working with Dick Murdoch at the Auditorium in Atlanta. And Murdoch was a heel, and he had built this huge head of steam up on Bob. And it was building and building and building, and finally they're ready to pop, and Bob starts to come back. And the people are coming up, and it was just, you know, I mean, it was just one of those electric moments. And Bob did the karate thing when he came out in the karate, you know, you talking about how fast he was. You remember he would move his arms and his hands real fast. He'd come out in that karate stance. When he came out in the karate stance, Murdoch just reached out and shook his hand. And it killed the whole thing. I mean, just killed it. Just dead 4 o'clock. Of course, all the boys thought it was hilarious, you know. But
as fast as he was with that, Bobby, was it ever just detrimental? You know, the fans didn't know anything about the sight problem Bob had.
Yeah.
But as far as you as a ref, did that ever cause problems being in the, you know, trying to stay out of his way?
No, not at all. Not at all. A lot of people thought Bob was very vain. If you ever watch a match with Bob, he's always looking down at he's flicking his fingers.
Mm-hmm.
His right hand, he was always flipping it, you know, and people thought he was looking at his chest or his arms or something.
Yep.
What he was doing, he was flicking his fingers. That's the way he focused.
Yeah,
that's
he would
he kept
do
his
that.
Eyes
he'd,
focused.
He'd rub his hands across the top of his trunks because, you know, he always wore the Olympic-type
right.
Body gear, and then he wore the trunks over them.
But that was what he was doing. He was focusing.
Yeah, he was focusing his eyes. I found that out after I got to know him. But it's funny, when I was still a fan in probably 78, 79, something like that, just before I started working the Analog Group I worked with in Pensacola, I was had regular tickets, and I would go to the matches every Tuesday night in Mobile. And Jerry Stubbs and I got together and decided I was going to I had bought it when I was much younger. Don Fargo had put together a book that they sold at the matches in Mobile of caricatures, because, you know, Fargo's an artist. And he did caricatures of the guys that were in the territory at the time. So I liked that idea, so I decided I would do that with the guys that were working in Mobile at the time for Fuller. And Stubbs and I went in on it, and they published it and everything. So that's a long story, but I won't go into all of it. But the character I did of Bob, I had him patting his stomach, saying, "Patty cake, patty cake." Well, that's before I realized that that's what he was doing, and so that's how he focused his eyes. It was like Bobby said, either flicking his hands or rubbing across the seam of his tights or whatever, so he could see. So, but he was an instant favorite with me. From the first time I saw him, it was a thrill to get to work under him as a booker. For as short as that run was, but it was fun.
I'll give you one other story. Since Jay mentioned the Loving Family, when the boys were all little, and they were like stair steps basically, and they would get in an argument or they'd get in a fight amongst themselves. Bob would make his wife go out of the room, because she had raised Cain, but he'd make her go out of the room. And he would move all the furniture in the living room of their house over to the side, and he'd make them fight. He'd say, "Y'all want to fight? Let's fight." And he'd make them fight. And then when they'd get through fight or decided they didn't want to fight, he'd make them kiss each other and tell each other they loved them. Brad and Scott both told me. He said, "Oh, it was awful." It was awful. He said, "But that's the way he dealt with it." And I remember another time Bob showing up in the dressing room somewhere, man, and I thought somebody had kicked his dog or something. He was just down. And I said, "What's the matter with you?" And he said, "Oh, I'm fixing to get sued." I said, "For what?" One of his kids, one of them, and I don't know which one, had climbed up on the coffee table and jumped off with an elbow on the neighbor's kid.
Oh, no.
So that was... I don't think that never came of it, but anyway, they like to kill some kid by jumping off the coffee table on him.
Well, you know, if that had just been any backyard neighbor's kid, probably no one would have thought about it.
Thought nothing about it.
But with that situation, he would have been charged with the wrestler showing his son some type of killer move, you know?
Yep.
Well, anyway, we could go on with Armstrong stories, but we got a list to go down.
The next name on our list is one I never had the pleasure of being around at all. Saw him work a lot of times, but never was around him. I'm sure you guys did. And that's Dick Slater.
Yeah, I was kind of refereed a ton of his matches. Dick was a heck of a hand. I mean, Dick could do anything he wanted to. He kind of developed where he had all those Terry Funk mannerisms.
Yeah.
And he kind of copied them, I guess. Dick was a heck of a hand. He could do anything he wanted to do in the ring, whether he was a heel or a babyface, it didn't matter. He drew a lot of heat. I think a tag team that's very underrated as far as people are concerned that never saw it was when Gary Hart came up with the brainstorm to put Slater and Bob Orton Jr. together as a team.
Oh, yeah.
And Gary managed them, and they made a heck of a team. Dick was, he was a Georgia heavyweight champion numerous times, both as a heel and a babyface. Him and Wrestling 2 had a great feud. Him and Dusty had a feud. Dick just he wrestled almost any and everybody. He stayed here for a long time, and I never had a minute's problem with Dick. He was just, you know, other than stuff outside the ring where him and Wahoo would get together and do crazy stuff. But other than that, you know, he's very deserving of a Hall of Fame, especially for Georgia.
You know, mentioning some of the things about him, you working in the office there, Bobby, I would imagine you could write a book on Slater's activities and not even touch the ring stuff.
Oh, yeah, there was a few escapades.
Yes, and some that you probably don't even want to mention or think about, but, yeah, there were some. Some of them made the paper, some didn't. You know, mentioning Bob Arton Jr. there, who came from another wrestling family, I had forgotten about that team-up, but I would imagine that Orton Jr. probably learned as many lessons from that tag team alliance as he did from anything else earlier in his career.
Yeah.
Because those guys really, they worked a lot of matches, and they really worked well together. I enjoyed seeing them, and I that's one thing about this show. That's something that I'd totally forgotten about. But as Bobby said, Slater had a long career from the 70s to the mid-90s, and he worked here in Mid-Atlantic and Florida. He spent, unfortunately, some time in the WWF there towards the end of his career, where if you look at some of the websites now where they talk about how guys were destroyed and ruined that had worked in the South and had been big on the cable station and how they were buried when they went there, it was very unfortunate. He had a long career. He held the title, I believe, from what I saw, four times here in Georgia. He was here for eight years continuously, I think. He had pretty good background in high school and college as a wrestler and football player, trained by the Grahams. He, unfortunately, had, as a lot of the guys did, but more so than some, had some demons. And as you mentioned about the Wahoo situation, but then very, very much later on, he got in trouble with his situation with his girlfriend that made the news, and he was under house arrest and a few other things. But you want to remember these guys for their ring activities and not for those kind of things, because Bob Arton, he was a brawler, he was loud, he could do a great heel interview. He had those wild eyes and that crazy look, and he would, he would march back and forth through that little short run where he'd go forward, and then he'd turn around and go the other way, and the fans loved it. And he was a guy that could really draw heat and put on a good match. And I'm glad I had the opportunity to introduce him a few times and also to see his work, because it was excellent.
You mentioned him being trained by the Grahams. He, Mike Graham, Steve Kern, excuse me, and for at least a short while, Bob Orton Jr. all went to the same high school. I don't remember if it was Pinellas High School. They're all there in Tampa. And they were all friends from, of course, Mike and Jr., Bob Orton Jr. having fathers that were in the business, but Steve Kern and Slater, came up through them and got into the business as well. Like I said, I saw him in Florida. I saw him some here. I saw him later on in the early 80s. He was working in Texas, in San Antonio, for the Blanchards, and did well out there. And just like you said, worked Mid-Atlantic. Everywhere he worked real well. And I saw him when he worked for Watts, Mid-South there for a while. And just everywhere he went, he was good. And then, like Bobby said, you know, he got over just as much as a babyface as he did as a heel. I think that's a sign of how good a heel he is. Because like we said a couple of weeks ago on the show, that how popular a babyface is when a heel turns is indicative of how well he was over as a heel and how hated he was. But the fans just love to see him when he turns to the other side.
Well, I seen a picture of Dick at the Atlanta Fan Fest or whatever that thing was called it a couple of years ago, and I didn't know who he was. Dick's gained a little weight, and he was in a wheelchair at this thing. I think he's had a lot of back issues, which most of us do, and
I guess
the guys that worked every night more so than the referees. But it was he was. If he could have just tamed the outside activities a little bit, you know, there's no telling where his career would have went or could have went. But, you know, you just never knew what he was going to do outside the ring. And you're talking about the things that happened and didn't happen. I guess the scariest thing, and it's public knowledge now, but the scariest thing was the night that him and Wahoo were confronted by some people at outside a club here in Atlanta, and Wahoo had watched too many detective movies on TV, and he thought if you hit a guy in the head with the butt of a gun, it'd knock him out, and all it did was make the gun go off, and he shot Slater. Fortunately, it went through the fat part of the top of his leg and didn't hit an artery or anything, and Dick was able to make TV the next day, and you know, he never missed a shot, but I managed to keep that out of the paper.
You know, and to think about what the guys did, you know, we've talked about Tim Woods and what he was willing to do after that plane crash, but just to think even like that for you know, Slater to make TV and all of his shots after being shot in the leg.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just unbelievable. You talked the other night about, you know, being concerned about, you know, if you're not there, whatever it is, somebody else can get your spot. But
yeah. But
just to think about being a professional, you know, just caring about your business and caring about your job and making sure that the fans see what they're supposed to see and being willing to you know, work under those conditions, because there were, as you well know, there some guys that would say, no, I can't work. I'll go around and sign autographs or something, but I can't work with this.
Yeah.
And to think about a guy being willing to do that, that's professional.
Yep.
Exactly. Or as guys Bobby had to deal with later on, just before he ended his career in the business, guys whose grandmothers died 15 times. I won't call any names, but his initials were Buzz Sawyer.
Yeah, geez.
But in some of the cases, they may not have been able to remember whether they did die or not, you know?
That's a fact.
I'm sure that was quite the case.
That's a fact.
He couldn't remember who he was most of the time. Not to speak ill of the dead, but that was one person I was glad I never had to have been offered the choice of whether to work with him or to go home. Because I think I'd have gone home.
Well, you know, there's another guy that had a world of talent. He did great interviews.
Absolutely.
He could work good in the ring, but you just never knew where his head was because he didn't know where it was. And he
he hurt you. He'd hurt himself. He'd hurt you.
Yeah.
And never know the difference.
No easy way to say it. He was so addicted to the drugs at that point in time in his career that he just, you know, he couldn't help himself.
All right, well, the next name on our list, and again, this is a gentleman that I never got to see enough of, but when I did, I was thoroughly impressed with him, especially his interviews, and that's Nick Bockwinkel.
Never had the privilege of being in the ring with Nick. When he came back into Georgia and made some shots, I was in the office, and I didn't get a chance to be in the ring with him, but through the Cauliflower Alley Club, I've gotten to know him a little bit the last several years, and what a gentleman. I mean, I don't know how you start to describe Nick Bockwinkel. He was as smooth and as good a worker as anybody that's ever been in the business.
Oh, absolutely.
Probably one of the best tag teams that's ever been in the existence of our business was him and Ray Stevens. The interviews were just absolutely, you can't describe those interviews. People have to, you got to YouTube and see this guy. They put Bobby Heenan with him, which would be equivalent to putting me with Neil Armstrong and me doing an interview talking about walking on the moon. I mean, I never quite understood that, but, you know, it worked, I guess. But Nick was just, he's a class act. He still is. Nick's up in years now, and he's slowed down considerably, but he is still an absolute gentleman and a prince to be around. And I mean, I can remember as a kid, Georgia was the first territory he ever worked heel in. He'd been a babyface his whole career till he came to Georgia.
Right.
And what a heel he was. I remember an interview. I can still remember it. I was a kid watching the matches, and I can still remember him coming out. They had him working with Dory Funk Jr., and he come out with a dictionary, and he read the definition of funk. And I thought it was just, I mean, now that I look back on it, I mean, just what a classic interview that was. But good guy.
Well, Nick Bockwinkel, you know, he born in 1934 from a wrestling family. I'll just say seeing much of his work from the late 60s on up until he basically retired, the AWA went away. He's one of my five favorite wrestlers of that era. Held the AWA championship many times when Gagne was wanting to take a break. The tag team championship he held many times. He could carry anybody in the ring. Very classy guy, did a great interview. I got a little bit of a different opinion, and I've stated that many times about how Bobby feels about Heenan and Nick Bockwinkel. But, you know, those were guys where when they worked an interview, one could start the sentence and the other could finish it. They were so smooth working together, and you could look at them sometimes and know that they just really wanted to laugh out loud, but they weren't going to do it because they were having such a good time doing those interviews. And they really work well that together doing that. But Bockwinkel himself did that, you know, looking down your nose, snide interview that was just, it was fantastic. But not only that, he could take that and then produce in the ring. I mean, there was guys that were great interviews that really had to be carried, you know. And then there were other guys that were exceptional in the ring, but you put the mic in front of them, and, you know, you might as well be talking to a bedpost. You know, you take somebody like Gordon in order to actually talk for him. But Bockwinkel was excellent. He was a fantastic interview, whether it was by himself or with Heenan. And that man was unbelievable in the ring. And when he put that sleeper hold on, you believed it. You know, and that was part of the business. You had to believe what they were doing, and he was fantastic. I remember one time in the late 60s, I'd been in the Army, and I was out in Colorado. This was in 68, and I saw him on the AWA show out there. But at any rate, I came back to Georgia, and he would come in and out of here, and even though he was basically a heel by that time, and mostly in the big publications would show him as such. He had a feud here with the Assassins, and you know, he got over as a babyface, and those were good matches, and this was around late 68, and you know, he was just unbelievable, and people that never had a chance to see him live, they really missed out, because he was one of the, as I said, the exceptional wrestlers of that period, and one of my five favorites from that era. He was great.
Well, the thing about him is he got all his heat as a heel through his interviews because he was still a scientific wrestler in the ring.
Right. He would use Heenan or whoever his partner was to do most of the dirty work.
Right. And Bobby mentioned he and Ray Stevens as a tag team. I saw them for the first time together again in Tampa. They simultaneously held the AWA World Tag Team title and the Florida State Tag Team title at the same time. But the AWA, their schedule was so light, especially in the summertime. I think they worked maybe, you know, 12 dates a month or something like that at the major cities the Midwest, and then so that gave them plenty of time to spend. I think they were in Florida a little over a month together, and and getting off of Bockwinkel for a minute. But a lot of people talk about, you know, they don't see what was so great about Ray Stevens. Well, all they know of Ray Stevens is from the 80s, you know, when he was at the last legs of his career and as many bumps as he'd taken all those years. So people don't realize Ray Stevens started when he was 15 years old. He started, had his first professional match, you know, in Columbus, Ohio, which is where he was from, in 1952. So, you know, he'd been in the business 35 years when a lot of people, you know, saw him. And I've heard more than one person say, you know, name the best bump taker ever in the history of the business, and Ray Stevens is the first name out of their mouth. And, you know, you don't get too many of your peers that will say that about you. Even Sputnik said that about him. Sputnik, of course, said he was number two, but, you know, Ray Stevens
right.
was the best.
I was surprised one of the times Stevens came to Atlanta. He wasn't here much. At least during the time that I was ring announcing, but he came in one night. I guess he was going to Florida or something. But at any rate, most of the fans didn't know him unless they knew him from the magazines. But I was surprised when he got in the ring. I was in there waiting on him to come down and how short he was, you know. But, he really was. For all the bloodbath pictures of him, you'd see the blade job and whatnot in the magazines where he's working with these giant guys. And he was really, in comparison, a small guy, but he was another one that, particularly in certain parts of the country, was a major star.
Yeah, San Francisco especially. And one of the best feuds that he had in San Francisco was with Bill Miller, if you can imagine that pairing.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the next on our list is a tag team, and this was genuinely an odd couple. That's Ray Gunkel and Buddy Fuller.
I was never in a ring with either one of them. Watched them growing up as a kid. Of course, Gunkel owned the territory. Fuller was a partner in the territory. They were business partners that hated each other. But they worked well together as a team, and the people believed in them. I really don't know a whole lot you can say about it. They just, you know, they never as a team, they never lost. Or if they did, it was some sort of fluke. It was never an out. I don't ever remember seeing them out and out get beat. Of course, if you own territory, you don't have to get beat. but they had feuds with everybody. You know, they booked themselves up and down the card. You know, Ray would work sometimes as a single. He'd do the second, third match on a card. Buddy, same thing. Buddy was up and down. Buddy would work cards. And back then they were still doing 2 out of 3 fall matches. So generally the semifinal, the main event was 2 out of 3 falls. I've seen Buddy worked with Bunk Harris at the time was wrestling Here's the Baby Blimp. I've seen those guys work 45 minutes together. I've seen Gunkel work with Stacey. I can remember as a kid seeing Gunkel work with Stasiak, and at the 45-minute mark of an hour match, Stasiak gave up with a hammerlock. They were over. They were believable. Fuller's leg lock was instant win anytime he hooked it on anybody. Gunkel used a hold called the Texas Octopus, which was sort of like a very similar to an abdominal stretch, only he got it on the out, so he didn't hook under the guy. He went over the guy and threw a leg over his head. But it was they were very believable, and they were very over, and they worked on top here a long time.
Did they have I'm assuming, I never saw Ray Gunkel work. I've seen film of Buddy working, but it was in later on in the 70s when he would come out of retirement every once in a while to work with his kids. But I've seen Ron and Robert work enough to know he probably worked a lot like them.
Very similar.
You know, and of course him being, you know, Tennessee from the Wells family in Tennessee, I'm sure the bulk of his stuff was, you know, punching and kicking and all that. But Gunkel with a legit amateur background from Purdue, were they a mixture where one of them did more wrestling and the other one was kind of like the hothead of the group? Or
it was, you know, the way I remember it, it was kind of equal. Fuller was elbows, knees, legs, arms. I mean, he was tall and lanky, and you know, he of the two, Robert and Ron, I think probably Ron is closer to what his dad was than Robert was. Robert was a little fierier than Buddy was, but you know, I honestly can't remember Gunkel doing a lot that much mat wrestling. Maybe he did, and I just don't remember it. But, you know, I mean, they stressed he was from Purdue and Big Ten and this and that, but it was never made a big, huge issue because everything Gunkel did, like I said, he was sort of the policeman. He wouldn't work for a while, and some guy would be getting over real good, and he'd be the top heel, and here comes Gunkel to wrestle him. And, of course, you know, the only time I ever remember seeing Gunkel do anything as a way of an angle to build something up, in the late 50s, early 60s, one of the biggest feuds they'd ever had in Georgia was Ray Gunkel and Freddie Blassie. I mean, they said it drew big money back then, and it was a hot, ongoing thing for weeks and weeks and weeks. And those two hadn't wrestled each other in a long time, so I can remember one time they were booked against each other, and my uncle, who very seldom said anything about the matches other than we just went, he said, "Man," he said, "you're going to see something tonight," he said, "when Gunkel and Blassie hook up." I can remember him telling me that. And the match prior to Gunkel and Blassie was Mario Galinto and somebody. And Galinto was still in the ring when they rang the bell for the next match, and when Blassie came in the ring, Galinto jumped him, put him in the hangman, and left him injured in the match. And when Gunkel got out there, of course, Blassie couldn't wrestle. And I can remember my uncle turning to me and he says, "I want my money back. We need to go." I mean, he was that adamant that, you know, he was going to see this thing, and it was. You know, that was a little angle they shot, and I think at some point later Blassie and Gunkel might have even teamed up. But
that's what I was going to ask you. Was that a turn for him when he did that?
Similar. You know, Blassie worked babyface some there toward the end of his career here.
Sure.
But, God, he was such a dynamic heel. I mean, he didn't.
Yes.
He was one of those people. He didn't have to do anything. He just had to walk out on stage and blow a kiss, and it was over.
Yeah.
But, I just, as far as Gunkel and Fuller was concerned, I don't remember him doing a whole lot of anything other than they were the policemen. They were the guys that was going to come in and beat whoever.
I never saw Ray Gunkel and Buddy Fuller work live together. But if those that are old enough to remember live Atlanta wrestling before it became Georgia Championship Wrestling, back in the days on Channel 11, the show would start with a film segment that was taken at the auditorium, and Sousa March would play, and it was Ray and Buddy teaming against whoever. And that little film segment ran for many years. And I think it kind of personified who were the guys that people wanted to see here, because they really didn't work on TV, you know, unless it was a build-up for a really big match. You wouldn't see either one of them work. They do interviews occasionally and things like that. I remember occasionally Ray would jump in the ring to maybe help somebody out, but as far as actually having a match on TV, they didn't do it. But during that era, they were the top dogs. I was, towards the end of Ray's career, I was very devastated when I heard the news that he'd passed away. And we know what happened after that. But I saw Buddy one time at the Omni with his two sons, as Mike was mentioning, about occasionally coming out of retirement. It was about the third or fourth match on the show that night, which another loaded card of that era. And him and his two sons worked against, let me see, who was it? The Garvins. all three of the Garvins against the Pillars, and you know, kind of a gimmick match, but that was fun to watch. They were certainly a successful team, Gunkel and Fuller, as we've talked many weeks, not to really get along personally, and they were of that era. I would say you'd probably have to say they were the babyface team that folks wanted to see.
Bobby, you mentioned that they worked with everybody, but I would say, at least from what I knew of the Georgia era or area through magazines and everything, it seemed like they worked best or the most with Tom and Jody as the Assassins.
They worked with Tom and Jody. They worked with J.C. Dykes, the Infernos. They worked with the Medics. I imagine if you looked hard enough and long enough, they probably even worked with the Von Bronners. They just, I mean, they, you know, they were good. I'll tell you, the only team that I think that, and I'm talking babyface teams of that era that I can remember as a kid that I really liked, when they did the turn, you know, they had a big feud with Buddy Fuller and Sputnik. Had a huge feud, went on for weeks. They did a turn with Sputnik, made him a babyface, and they teamed him and Fuller up together. And, man, this thing was it was building up to a big thing at Christmas night. They had a show Christmas night that year, whatever year it was, and I can't remember who they were working with, but Sputnik showed up drunk. They fired him, and that ended it. But that was the only other team that I can remember being, you know, where people just were crazy for it.
Unbelievable, a talented band through this territory. Well, that completes the 2012 class. So before we move into 2013, I'm going to have another Monty Hall moment and turn it over to Jay for another word from our sponsor real quick.
Well, all righty. Let me push the button on my mic here for a second so you can't hear me clear my throat. The Peach State Pandemonium podcast is happy to be sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken digital audio entertainment and information. They have over 150,000 titles to choose from, and you can listen to them on any device, including whatever you're hearing us on right now. And if you sign up at our URL, which is audibletrial.com/GWHradio, you get one free audiobook and a one-month trial of the service. Okay, well, now you got to fill up the other 45 minutes, Mike.
It sounds so much different when Jay reads it as opposed to when
you
read
that's
it, Michael.
Reason, that's the reason. Why do you think he's reading? I'm thankful Rich suggested that.
Did you guys, since I joined you later, and I apologize for that, but working two jobs during the day is killing me.
Why are you doing two jobs during the day, Bobby?
Well, we had a young lady that had been our office manager for the last 29 years that I have been employed there. She got this wild hair and decided to retire.
Uh-oh.
So I am now the acting receptionist, payroll office manager, blah, blah, blah. Plus, I still have to do my job.
There you go.
So, you know, I close the front desk at 5:30, and then I have to do what I have to do to keep my job up and running. And it's just I've been doing 12 and 13 hour days, and it's just been a long couple of weeks. But
I get what you're saying now. When you said you were doing two jobs, I thought you were going from one to the other, but you're
doing two jobs. All in the same place, just trying to keep up.
Which doesn't count your church work too, also though. So
you throw that in too. So you know that means last night I didn't get home to almost 10 o'clock. So make those nights a little longer. But
he's
joining you late, and again,
jobs.
I apologize for that. But did you mention Bob Kelly by any chance?
No, I haven't yet.
We need to ask all our folks that's listening to please keep Bob Kelly in your thoughts and prayers. He's going to have a little chemotherapy, and he starts tomorrow. And he's doing okay, and he's going to be fine, but it's just something he's going to have to go through. And think good thoughts for him, and it would be very much appreciated. All of us that are part of the Gulf Coast Wrestling Reunion, we, you know, Bob's our president, and not only that, he's our friend, and to a lot of the people of that reunion, he's a hero because they grew up watching him, and Michael Norris was a toss-up between Cowboy Bob Kelly and Roy Rogers. And when he met Roy Rogers and found out he was an old man, I think he switched to Bob Kelly. But
Bob Kelly, absolutely.
Obviously, Mike knows how fast conditions can change, medical conditions can change in the hospital. But the initial reports that I heard on Mr. Kelly from Bill Sellier over there, as compared to what we're hearing now, sounds really great.
Yeah, he's going to be okay. It's just they seem to think he'll be in recession in no time, and remission, not recession. Remission. We're all in recession, but anyway, he'll be in remission in no time, and we're just. I hate he's having to go through the chemo, but if that's what it takes, then get him well. We'll deal with it.
Yeah, I can rib him because what little bit of hair he's got left, he'll probably lose that. Growing up watching Bob had a feud with somebody on the Mississippi end of the Gulf Coast, and I think it was Rocky. This was back when Rocky had a fuller head. They decided they were going to have a hair versus hair match, and then Rocket said that wasn't fair because Kelly was already going bald. Oh, man. Well, we just got through talking about this gentleman, but the first of the class of the 2013 class is, again, Buddy Fuller. Of course, a lot of people know or don't know that Buddy was the son of legendary Roy Welch and nephew of Jack Herb and Lester Welch, father to Ron and Robert Fuller, cousin to Lee Bobby Don Fields, nephew to Speedy Hatfield, uncle to Jimmy Golden, brother-in-law to Bill Golden. So he came from quite a family, and he was the promoter in Mobile before Lee Fields. He promoted there from 54 to December 59 when he sold out to Lee Fields. And, of course, he wrestled as well. They would bring in figurehead promoters like Leroy Morris and Skippy Wetchin and Les Wolf from Tennessee, and they set them up as promoters so Buddy could wrestle. And his biggest opponent in Mobile was Mario Valento. And them being two Tennessee guys who wanted to prove how tough they were, they didn't do blade jobs. They did hard ways every night.
Was Les Wolf related to any of those guys?
And we're talking about Les Wolf, the promoter, not
yes.
Les Buddy Wolf.
Right.
I don't know, but he was part of that Dyersburg gang like Rocky McGuire was, who was not related but might as well have been. Bobby mentioned Bunk Harris earlier. Bunk Harris was the same way. He lived on, I think it was Herb Welch's farm there in Dyersburg for many years, and wound up, doing something similar for Big Jim Crockett when he went to work for the Crocketts. He just was kind of a caretaker, somebody's home or something, besides wrestling. But they were all, the Welches were originally from Pawhuska, Oklahoma, but they all settled in Tennessee around Dyersburg in the 40s and pretty much stayed there. Obviously lived in Griffin for many years. The whole time he was involved with Atlanta, he lived in Tampa when he was involved in the Florida territory. I think he lived in Knoxville when he was helping Ron when Ron first bought Knoxville. He wound up in Pensacola when he was out of business. Of course, by that time, Ron had bought the Mobile territory from Lee, who had bought it from Buddy, and was at the headquarters of the Southeastern Mobile end of it was Pensacola, so I'm sure really, Ron probably moved Buddy down there to be closer to it. And everything, but Buddy would come back into Mobile periodically as late as, I think, 1970. I think he came in one time with Robert and teamed. But he was always a big draw there, second only to Lee Fields in popularity. And tell a story about the two of them together in Mobile. Now, I don't know if this was true or not. The story was told to me by Skippy Wetchin. But supposedly, Buddy's wife at the time was having a little thing with Lee Fields. Of course, Buddy and Lee were cousins. So rather than get mad at each other, Lee and Buddy put their minds together and decided they were going to pull a reel on all the boys and not tell anybody. They booked themselves in a match against each other. And all the boys were thinking, women, this is going to be a shoot. Bobby and Don, Lee's older brother or younger brothers, came. They weren't even booked that night. They deliberately left the two of them off the card. They showed up anyway because they thought they were going to have to separate them. So they went out there and worked a whale of a match, hard-weighed each other, just beat each other senseless. And all the rest of the guys on the card are standing there watching, thinking, oh, man, these guys are killing each other. They get back to the dressing room, close the door, start laughing and pointing at all the other guys and hug each other. Now, that tells you that well, sense of humor, right?
Yeah, that's definitely an unusual one to beat yourself to death like that in a hard way match and then go back there and laugh about it, but that's it.
Yeah, just to get a rib on the boys.
Right. I would really like to see a spread out on that family tree.
I can give it to you.
Okay.
Well, you can only give them a partial one because we don't know about all the things that's not listed.
Well, yeah, the ones.
I was
going to
say, you know, the truth, you know, and of course, I met a lot of them and worked with a lot of them, and I consider them, you know, God, they're dear friends, and those that have gone, I really miss. But I'll tell you something. If you were to just start digging and do a whole, we could do 3 or 4 months worth of shows, just on the talent that came out of Dyersburg, Tennessee.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, just geez, you just think about the people that, and you know, it wasn't just for that. You know, I mean, it. We're talking right on up through the 70s. I mean, there was talent that came out of there. We had a lot of young kids that came here out of Dyersburg. One that pops in mind, me and Charlie were talking about the other, there was a kid named Roger Howell.
Oh, yeah.
Again, not a big kid,
Roger.
But what a hand he was.
Yep.
And he come out of that Dyersburg thing, worked on one of them's farm up there.
Probably Herb. Herb had a school up there.
He
trained, like, well, probably the biggest name that Herb Wells trained was Dr. D. David Schultz.
Jerry Barber came out of there.
Jerry Barber, yeah.
But
a quick rundown
Jerry,
of all
Jerry
those.
Still lives in Dyersburg.
Yep.
I mean, anyway, I didn't mean to get off track there, but I just got to thinking about all the talent that come out of that place when you got to talking. And,
yep. People talk about the Hamilton factory in Hamilton, Ontario. All the guys that came out of that field, Dyersburg's probably pretty close.
Yes.
I had forgotten about that Roger Howell, though. That's another thing about this show. Just names pop up that you just totally forgotten about.
Yeah.
I'll tell you another person, this ain't got nothing to do with what we're talking about, but I'll tell you another one, Jay, that I saw in Vegas this year that I had not seen in years, and maybe you remember him or not, but I saw Lynn Denton.
Oh my goodness, yes.
Yeah, saw Lynn in Vegas this year.
He worked under the mask. What was who did he
the
work
grappler.
As? Yeah, the grappler.
Yeah.
Yes, he worked here for quite some time.
Yes, he did.
I introduced him many times.
I walked up to him, and he looked at me, and he goes, I know you, and I told him who I was, and his remark to me was, we were just babies back then.
Yeah, he and Tony Anthony were the grapplers and the dirty white boys.
Yeah.
And Lynn stayed under the hood as the grappler for most of his career, I would say. But going back to answer your question about the Welches, I'll do this real quick. the original four. Now, I've heard that the father, the patriarch of the family, was a gentleman named Edward Welch, who Buddy was named for, was a wrestler in the late 1800s, early 1900s, but I've never been able to confirm that, but that's always been the legend. So not counting him, the four original brothers were, Roy was the oldest, Jack was next, Herb was third, Lester was fourth, the youngest. Their sister Bonnie Welch was married to Virgil Hatfield, better known as Speedy Hatfield, who was a promoter and a referee. Roy Welch's son was Edward Welch, was his Buddy Fuller. Lester's two sons were Lester Jr., better known as Jackie, and Roy Lee Welch.
Right.
Jack had a daughter named JoJo, or Joanne. She worked most places as Joanne Phillips, but she was best known when she worked in Tennessee or in Mobile, where the Welch family was known. She worked as JoJo Welch. let's see. Herb had a son, Doyle, and a son, Bobby, who wrestled, but very short. Neither one of them, you know, wrestled for very long, maybe a couple of years each. Virgil and Bonnie Hatfield's sons were, of course, Lee, Don, and Bobby Fields. And Lee's son, Ricky, became a wrestler.
Right. How are the Golden Side in there?
Well, Buddy's, Roy's daughter, I don't remember her name, but Roy's daughter, Buddy's sister, was married to Billy Golden.
Okay.
Billy Golden was a referee and promoter. Their son was Jimmy.
Okay.
And so going back to that generation, or the generation after that, I should say, besides Lee's son, Ricky, Don's son, Johnny, wrestled. Don's brother-in-law, Buddy Carson, refereed and wrestled under the name of Marshall Fields. Back to the Goldens, Bill Golden's brother was Phil Golden, who was a promoter in, out of Paducah, Kentucky. Let's see, Bobby Fields' sons, Shane, Anthony Shane, Lynn, and Bobby Jr. all worked as referees.
Quite a group.
As far as yeah, there's 27, 28 of them.
Wow.
And then, where did Randy fit in?
Randy Lynn, Anthony Shane. None of them would use the Fields name.
Oh, okay.
And then Bobby Jr. They all worked as referees, but Bobby Jr. didn't work under Lee. He worked for Ron Fuller. And of course, since then, and you can count them, but not really, because they never worked full time. Jimmy Golden's son has wrestled, as well as Ron Fuller's son Chad has wrestled. And Chad's probably an inch taller than Ron. If you can believe that. Big family.
And Ray Stevens wrote a song about him called "I'm My Own Grandpa." It was Oscar and Homer and Oscar.
Yeah, Oscar and Lonzo and Oscar.
Lonzo and Oscar, that's it.
And Homer and Jethro. Homer and Jethro did it too.
Jeez.
And that's like Bobby said. That's not mentioning all the others that are branched in.
Yeah, you could have a whole stable of workers right there without going outside the family, you know.
I mean, you think about the talent he just mentioned.
Yes.
I mean, you think about the talent for the era in which we were, and, you know, and all of them, I mean, they were all very smart in their own way about the wrestling business, but none of them were rocket scientists either.
Right.
But, you know, Buddy, everything Buddy touched there for a lot of years turned to gold. I've heard this story, and I've heard it my whole life, and I know it's got to be true because I've never heard anybody dispute it. Buddy found out when I-75 was going to be built, and he found out where it was going, some way or another. You know, one thing about the wrestling business, everybody knew somebody that knew somebody.
Yeah.
You could get anything you wanted. If you needed tires or you needed a car, I mean, somebody knew somebody. Well, he found out where I-75 was going through, and he went down to Locust Grove and bought some property. Now, Locust Grove back in the 60s would be like moving to the Amazon jungle.
Yep.
I mean, there was nothing down there. It was just a little country town. And he bought the land for probably nothing. And the deal was, the way I understand it, in order for them to give you top dollar, you had to be living on the property when they came through to buy it.
Yep.
And they tell me he moved in a shack on this property. No running water, no electricity, but he moved into this shack and lived in it until they came along and bought this property.
Well, you know, and that makes sense then, because the Fullers for a while were, when they would be introduced, would be from Locust Grove, Georgia.
That's exactly right. And that's where the farm came in Griffin, is when he sold that property. He bought the farm in Griffin, and he built that building down there, which I think was originally going to be a horse barn or something, and they turned it into the Griffin Sports Palace.
Yeah. Yeah. So that gave legitimacy to that Locust Grove by doing that. So.
There you go.
Well, that's something else Buddy always did, because what most people know is the Fields Brothers farm and our Fields Brothers ranch in Loxley, Alabama, was originally Buddy's when he first moved into that territory in 54. And he on that, and he would have he'd have rodeos out there. When he lived in Tampa, he had a big, huge ranch off Gun Highway in Tampa. And I'm assuming he had that ranch in Griffin was fairly large size, but that was something he always did. And they raised horses and did stuff like that. And the Fields, continued that for, 20, 25 years after they got the territory. That was part of the deal with Lee buying the property. I mean, buying the promotion. Buddy said he had to buy the ranch, too, because he was leaving. So,
it's amazing. Ron, everything Ron touched there for a while turned to gold.
Yep.
I mean, it was just...
Still is, because Ron West told me before he passed away, Ron lives in Tampa, and he owns an ADT alarm franchise, and it's the most successful one in the whole state of Florida.
Wow.
I mean, he owned a semi-pro hockey team somewhere in Ohio at one time. He's done well everything he's ever done. But then just back to that name, not only wrestlers of that list, I look at the promoters. Buddy, Speedy Hatfield, Roy, of course, Lester, Lee Fields, Ron, and then Booker's from there. I mean, they all had and ran successful territories. That's why I tried a few years ago, I was talking to Jackie and Roy Welch. I said, somebody, and Lester, of course, was still alive then, as was Bobby and Don Fields. I said, somebody needs to, and by somebody I meant me, write a book about the Welch family, because people just don't realize how much they dominated wrestling from the 40s through the 80s between all the promotions that they owned. And it's just, but, of course...
They didn't want to give away the business by even doing a book, right?
Exactly. That and they wanted money up front. That was another Welch trait there. But I've talked to Scott Till about it, because Scott knows about it as much as anybody, having lived in Florida and Tennessee. That's something that needs to be put down somewhere. Of course, there's nobody anymore other than Jackie and Roy Lee. Ricky's still around, but doesn't have a whole lot to do with the business. Johnny, who was Don's son, has nothing to do with the business. Wants nothing to do with the business. Won't even tell anybody he's a Fields.
Who's that?
Johnny Wayne Fields, Don's son. He's never been to the reunion.
Oh, okay.
Last I heard, he was managing a seafood restaurant in Pensacola, but he was a heck of a worker back in his day. Small, of course, all of them were small compared to some of the other territories, but great workers. Ricky was a great wrestler, but Ricky, always told me he hated the business. Never wanted to be in it. And he was probably in the business 5-6 years before he got out.
Yeah, he had a run in here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they teamed him and Buzz Sawyer together. But anyway, we talk on, and we ought to do that. We'll plan tonight, and we'll get Scott on to join us, and maybe Les, and then we'll talk about. We'll go through the whole history of the Welch family one night. May even take more than one night. But anyway, the next name on our list, most people will remember is Chief Jay Strongbow, but he was voted in as Joe Scarpa, which is how the older of us remember him. What a whale of a worker, and what a difference between his work as Scarpa and his work as Strongbow. Of course, he was
international TV star.
Yep.
The first feud I remember when I started going to the matches, the first feud I ever remember that really caught my attention was Joe Scarpa and Stan Stasiak. And it was also the first time I ever remember, first match I ever saw where it had a loser leave town stipulation. And I can sit here now, I'm just thinking about it. There was some bloodbaths. And it was one of those deals. Scarpa was a heck of a babyface, and he was one of them crazy babyfaces. You know, when he got the bleeding, or he made his comebacks. I mean, he had so much fire, and he was just, you never knew what he was going to do. I mean, he may grab a chair or the hammer off the bell key or the timekeeper's table, or it was one of those deals. Just a heck. I mean, I was enthralled as a child. I mean, I'm sitting here thinking about it, getting goosebumps. It was just one of those things that I remember so much and love so much. Never had a chance to work with him as Joe Scarpa, but I worked many times with him as Jay Strongbow. And by that time in his career, he was like the rest of us. His goal in life was to make a dollar and not get hurt. But he could still work. He could still work. If we ever develop a penny pinchers Hall of Fame, I'm not sure who's going to go in first, him or Ted Allen, but I believe I really believe that that Joe Scarpa made Ted Allen look like a big spender. he could squeeze them George Washingtons, but. Nice guy. He was a pleasure to be around, pleasure to be in a ring with, and a great friend of his. He wasn't reclusive. I don't know if that's the right word or not, but Joe was very close-knit. He was very, very protective of his friends, and he knew how to distinguish a friend and an acquaintance. One of the guys, one of his dear friends, and he has become a friend of mine. His name is Tom Stevenson. Ted Allen was in Tom's wedding, and that's how I met Tom. But Tom and the Chief were very, very, very close, and we've had a lot of discussions about the Chief. Some night when we want to talk Strongbow, we need to get Tom to join us. He's got some stories that he can probably tell. Joe was a good guy, but he's definitely not only in the Wrestling Hall of Fame, he's in that Penny Pinchers Hall of Fame as well.
Well, what Jay Bobby alluded to about the international TV star, tell Jay that story because I'm sure he's never heard it. You'll get a kick out of it.
Supposedly, Chick Donovan was playing golf one day, and Scarpa happened to be on the same course playing golf. And, of course, Chick with that long blonde hair and the tan and the whole bit. And, he noticed Scarpa looking at him. He didn't know who Scarpa was.
Really?
And, no, had no clue. And when it was over and they got through playing, they were by the clubhouse or whatever, and Scarpa was standing there. And Chick, with his ego, walked over and said, "You must have recognized me. I'm Chick Donovan, international TV wrestling star."
Oh, my God.
And Scarpa said, no, never heard of you. He said, but maybe you've heard of me. My name's Joe Scarpa. So, you know, and knowing Scarpa, he never cracked a smile. He never changed his expression, you know. But, yeah, that was that's supposedly a true story.
The first time I saw Chick Donovan in many, many years was at Ted Allen's funeral. And I recognized him right off, not as an international star, but somebody that I remembered from, having a much different persona than an international star from the 70s when I introduced him a few times. Joe Scarpa, my memory of him as Joe Scarpa was from TV. Ed Capel interviewing him on Live Atlanta Wrestling. And he was an okay interview. He was a scientific wrestler. He was a fan favorite. And this was the late 60s, once again, right after I was out of the Army. And didn't see him again for a while. And then all of a sudden, one night, I was home because I had the flu or something. This was around 1970. Channel 36 had started showing it was either the Pittsburgh show. I thought Bill Cardale was doing the announcing, but it could have been the Cap City show. But all of a sudden, there was this guy in a headdress there, and doing an interview. And my father and I were watching, and because this is the first time we'd seen this show. And I said, "Daddy, who is that?" And he said, "I don't know." And I said, "Look at him." And we saw the nose and everything, and he said, "That's Joe Scarpa." And I said, "You're right." And the next thing he was in the ring and doing the war dance, and basically that was the last time Joe Scarpa was ever seen, or discussed, because he kept that persona when he would go home to Griffin to himself, but he was definitely Chief J. Strongbow from that point on in the ring, and had a very, very successful career with it. But the personas were, even though they were both baby faces, were so different. And it was really uncanny. It was almost like a split personality. But he had a big career, and he as the chief, was on a lot of magazine covers. And I talked to him late in his career when he was working for Thunderbolt a little bit, a couple of times. But and he also, I introduced him one time when he was in Atlanta, late in his career when he worked for Georgia Championship Wrestling. I remember that day very well because he'd been away for a while, and he came in, and Ernie Ladd was in, and that was the bit, what they did.
Yep.
He got in the ring, and Ladd destroyed his headdress. And
took the feathers in his mouth.
Oh, yeah, and it went on from there, but... two different guys. When you're talking about Jay Strongbow and Joe Scarpa, to be the really same person, they were definitely two different guys. But I remember Joe Scarpa, the professional wrestler, quite well, and he was he was a main eventer, and he should have been. And but he made the name as his later persona.
Yeah, he used to when he was Jay Strongbow, people would question his Native American heritage, and he'd tell everybody he was a full-blooded Sicilian.
A full-blooded what?
Sicilian. And sometimes he'd say he was a full-blooded Wapaho.
Yeah, there you go.
I love it.
All right, the next name on our list, and this guy's so shy and unassuming. It's amazing that he ever drew enough attention to himself. And that's Wes Thatcher, our good friend.
Believe it or not, I never was in the ring with Les. We never crossed paths. He was moving toward working in the office and doing the TVs as I was getting started. And I watched him wrestle a lot of times when I was growing up. And I say this, and I don't try to be funny, because a lot of the guys think you're ribbing and you're aggravating them when you say you watched them as a kid, but most of these guys I saw as a kid, coming up and in my early teens, and I remember Les coming into Atlanta, him and Roger Kirby and Dennis Hall as the wrestling cousins, and Watched him wrestle a lot of times. Had the privilege of being in a ring with Dennis and Roger, but never got to a list. But I've worked many TV shows with him and had the privilege to travel with him a little bit and seen him run seminars and do different things. And Les has done it all in our business. He was a great worker, and he's probably one of the premier announcers. I remember one of the funny things I remember about him, and I told somebody this the other day. A guy asked him one time, he says, you don't get very excited when you're calling a match. And Les's response to him was, I've seen a hammerlock before. So, you know, he's a less good guy. If we can ever get him to come out of his shell, we're going to be okay with him. But I'm very happy to call him my friend.
That's the thing about a lot of people throw out a lot of different names as far as, you know, the best commentator of this. But to me, 1A and 1B are Gordon Sullivan and Les Thatcher.
And they worked well together.
Yes, they did.
In-ring performer, commentator, writer, and later a trainer running his own wrestling school. But when I was my first stint as ring announcer on TV in 1974 when we were doing the one-hour show because All South was still running, when I left that, then Les had made a few appearances on the TV, and he was still working a little bit in ring, but he was moving towards getting out of that, doing the commentary and the other things. And he came in and he worked with Gordon, and then he started doing the information in the ringsider for a while, and then he moved on from that. But that was the first time I really paid much attention to him, not so much from his ring work, which was excellent as a junior heavyweight, but as his announcing skills and his work as a writer. But he worked with Gordon and Bob Caudle and Lance Russell and Jim Ross and many more. So he had the credentials, and he worked with a lot of the greats. And it's good to know that the guy of his caliber is still around.
Well, that. But I mean, when he went to work for Fuller, when Ron opened Knoxville, and Les was his more or less producer. I mean, he formatted the show and everything else because what was the gentleman's name that had John Kazana, who had Knoxville for many, many, many years prior to Fuller buying him out. You know, they just kind of showed up and just did whatever they did. And it had to have been a shock for those fans that watched that show for so many years to have somebody like Les, who actually knew what he was talking about and calling the holds and all that, because Big Jim Hess, who I loved the little bit I've seen of him, I absolutely loved him as far as a personality, but a wrestling commentator he was not. Everything they did was a whip your head off hold. And he spent more time arguing with Ron Wright than he did anything else. And which those people ate up because he was one of them. You know, he was like a fan sitting there. But it had to be so different because Les was like Gordon Sully, and he made it sound like a true. He was calling a true sport. And of course, Les, having been a great wrestler for so many years, he knew what to call, what holds were called, and everything else. But I had the pleasure of watching him wrestle in Mobile. He came into Mobile a couple of times after the cousins had their long run there. They were in Mobile together probably a little over a year. And I tease him about it all the time because Bobby Shane was getting over in Georgia at the time as the Boy Wonder.
Mm-hmm.
And so Rocky McGuire, who was booking for Lee Fields at that point in the Mobile Pensacolian, when they worked the Louisiana and they worked the Cousins gimmick, and it was actually him and Roger teaming more than Roger and Dennis. But when they moved up to the northern end of the Gulf Coast Territory, Rocky McGuire, who was booking that in, decided, well, Bobby Shane's getting over, we're going to tell everybody Les Thatcher is a boy wonder. And they told everybody he was, you know, 16 or 17 years old. And Les got upset because he couldn't go to the clubs and couldn't date women and stuff like that because, you know, he had a bad image. But what Bobby was talking about, going back to what he was saying about people saying they watched people as a kid, Les said the first time they went into Louisiana, Bob Kelly had just taken over booking from Bill Golden. Bill Golden had left, and Bob Kelly started booking down there. This was late 66, something like that. And, of course, Les, having started in his, you know, home area of Cincinnati, and I think Louisville, Kentucky at that part was part of that region there. Before Goulas got it, or Jared got it, or whoever in Louisville. Dick the Bruiser had Louisville, and Les and would work over there periodically. Les said the first time he went to show in his first show in Louisiana, Kelly walked up to him and said, I remember seeing you wrestle before I got in the business. And Les said, well, who are you? He said, I'm the booker. Oh, man. She wasn't sure they made a smart decision coming to Louisiana, but the three of them got over like gangbusters. And Les made a couple trips back later on, you know, in the 70s by himself, and always was a tremendous worker. And just a great baby face. But, of course, when Ron Fuller started in Mobile and with Southeastern, they had Gordon Sully there for the first couple of months to kind of get the ball rolling, and then they brought Les in. And Les was there probably a year or so before he moved on to doing other stuff. But you mentioned him doing writing. He's the one that put together the programs for the Crockett's, and he was the first one to do a personality profile and stuff like that. And he just is. Production, television production was just very innovative from what you saw as regular territorial wrestling in those days.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the final name on our list, and I'd give anything if he'd return my phone calls or if I could know for sure he's okay, is Roberto Soto.
Roberto got a break here in Georgia. Well, he had worked several places, but he got a break here in Georgia when Tom Ernesto put the Georgia Heavyweight Championship on him, and that sort of legitimized him. Had a running feud that went for years with Billy Spears. Nice guy, funny guy, and definitely a ladies' man. But he was
well, that's his brother Manny.
Yeah, it was Manny. But he's, you know, Roberto was had the privilege of riding, making a lot of trips with him. Just a super nice guy. But, yeah, I mean, probably as smooth a worker as anybody I've ever been in a ring with and could do anything. Had one of the prettiest flying head scissors of anybody I've ever seen do that move. He had great matches with Jody Hamilton. He had great he had great matches with everybody he was in the ring with. I don't remember him having bad matches. Him and Wayne Cowan had a little disagreement in Savannah one night, but other than that, I don't remember him having any problems with anybody in this territory as far as working was concerned. Had a good run here and came back many times. And fortunately for me and several others, we kind of reconnected in Mobile a few years ago, and I'm like you. He needs to come out of the woodwork and let us know where he's at. He moved from Pensacola to we think he went back to another place in Florida, but we're not sure. So just hope he comes back, gets back in touch with us, and so we can keep this going. Funny guy. Funny guy.
First time I noticed him was during the early stages of the matchup with Billy Spears. And as I've said previously, they put on every kind of match you could think of. You know, falls don't count. I even saw him in a boxing match at the sports arena. But those guys always put forth 120% any night they were working together or whoever they were working with. And he was very smooth. He had a little problem with the language, so it made it difficult for him. If you hear a meow in the background, it's my cat here wondering why I'm not feeding him right now. It's past his feed time. At any rate, a little problem, doing the interviews, even though he would do what he could when he had to. Always excellent performer. I can remember him as being one of the guys that wore two knee protection on both knees, and he would kind of talk to himself a little bit, and he was extremely believable. I enjoyed his work. I'm wondering, did he ever talk to either one of you guys about being Invader number two?
Yes. Yeah.
I was not. Oh, go ahead.
He didn't like the gimmick.
He wanted to be Milman Scarce number two.
But I don't know if you know what I was leading up to or not, but
the Brody thing.
Yes.
He was there that night. He told me.
Yes. I never knew that until a few years ago. A couple of the times that he got together at Bobby's church and whatnot, even at that point, I didn't know about it. But a couple of years ago, I was reading something on Brody, and I realized that Gonzalez, his partner, as Invader number two, was Roberto Soto.
Yeah.
And, a lot of folks just don't talk about that night.
He had Cologne had called him and asked him to come to Puerto Rico. And, of course, Manny and Roberto were both originally from Puerto Rico. And they got their start in the business up in New York where, I guess, Rock or somebody ran a school up there. That guys like Don Serrano, Pedro Morales, Victor Rivera, Manny and Roberto, Burhead Jones, of all people, all came out of there. And Roberto's first territory, he worked for Tony Santos in New England. And Tony Santos named him Pepe Perez.
Right.
That was the first name. He left there and went to work for Gulas. I think he worked there, he said, 2 or 3 weeks before he realized he wasn't getting any money. And Gulas had him go into the wrestling under the name of Young Anaya. For those who remember Cyclone Anaya, if you've ever seen pictures of Cyclone Anaya, Roberto in his younger days looked quite a bit like him, so that they called him and billed him as Young Anaya. Well, after he left there, he wound up with the Fields in Louisiana, and there was a guy that had been in and out of Mobile a time or two by the name of Ray Lopez, but it was the name he was wrestling under. Well, they put the two of them together, and they became Ramon and Pepe Perez. And Roberto was maybe 16, 17 years old at that point. Ramon was a couple of years older. But they were together down there 3 or 4 years as a Perez. But had great matches with the Dolphins, especially Bill and Joe as the interns. They worked. The two of them for nearly a solid year and always do big houses. And then they split up, and Roberto went to Florida a little bit and came back to Mobile as Roberto Soto. I was there maybe 6 months or so. And then from there came to Georgia, and that's where he got his real, first push as a solo. But back to what you were saying, he had kind of gotten away from the business for a while, and then Cologne called him and asked him to come to Puerto Rico if he wanted to come to Puerto Rico and work. Well, he still had family down there, so he said sure. So he went down there. Well, after he got down there, they told him they were going to team him with Gonzalez, Jose Gonzalez, as the second Invader. Well, he didn't have a mask, and Gonzalez wasn't going to give him one of his because the two of them did not get along. So he found a guy that was that made masks there. So he had him make a mask. The only type of mask the guy knew how to make was one of them, like Neil Maskus wore, without the, you know, I mean, he'd leave the M off. So the night that Invader 2, Roberto Soto, debuted as Invader 2, he was working as part of a battle royal, and guess who else was in the battle royal? Neil Maskus. So Maskus got mad at him in the dress room and said, "That's my mask. You can't wear that mask." So Roberto said, if you know Roberto Soto at all, you know what that Latin temper, what he told Neil Maskus he could do. So he said, now this is Roberto relating all this to me. He said that Maskus went out, you know, made his grand entrance out to the battle royal. And so when it came his time to come out, he said he sucked his stomach in, stood on his tiptoes, and held his hands out in front of him and walked slightly Maskus out of the ring. But he said that the night Brody got killed, of course, it happened in the shower away from him, so nobody actually saw anything happen. But he said he was sitting there, and he and Gonzalez were supposed to go out and work a tag match after that. And he said he wasn't working there, so he left and because of what had happened. And then after that, they turned him heel. His Invader 2 is a heel, so he could feud with Gonzalez. And he said the worst part about that, they stuck him with some little guy from Tennessee as his manager. He didn't even remember who he was. And the guy carried a gimmick cane, you know, so he could do like Saul Weingroff or somebody and hit somebody with a cane or something. And one night a fan took it away from him. And Roberto said he got out of the ring, walked over there, pushed his manager down, walked over and snatched the cane away from the fan and carried it back over there and gave it to him. He said, "Don't let me have to go after this again."
Oh, that's unbelievable, though, that the Invader wouldn't loan him a match to work the match. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Kind of just gives you another idea about the guy.
Yeah. The funniest story Soto ever told me was one of the times he was in Japan. You know, they were all on the bullet train going somewhere. And he said he was sitting there minding his own business, looking out the window, and Lou Fez walked up to him and said, "You're in my seat." And he said he just looked at him. He said he knew he was a shooter, he was a hooker and all that. He said he probably was going to kill me. He said, but I wasn't giving him this seat. He said, so he led into him and spat at him and told him what he could do.
Oh. Wow.
That's one person I would hate to have seriously mad at me.
He used to, I've told this before, but he used to swap cars at a place called Meadows Motors. Was in Manchester, Georgia. It was a GM Oldsmobile dealership. And the guy's name was Snooky Meadows. And Soto had met him somewhere or another, and that's where Soto bought all his cars. So we'll work Columbus on Wednesday night. And Soto always stayed over in Columbus on Wednesday nights. It was such a long trip, he had to stay over. he had business he took care of there. But anyway, we're going to Athens the next night, and it's my turn to drive. So I'm sitting at the place we were going to meet waiting on him, and he pulls up, and he's in a brand-new Oldsmobile 98. So he rolls the window down, and he hollers at me. He goes, "Grab your bag, come on." He said, "I'll drive." He said, "I want to see how the new car does." So back then, we met in Stockbridge. We rode 138 all the way up to 78 there in Monroe, and it was two-lane road, and you had several stop signs and turns you had to make. It's not like it is now. But
oh, yeah.
We made the trip up there fine. We worked the show up there, and we're coming home. And we're riding down the road, and we're talking. And we were riding down this little stretch of 138 between Conyers and Stockbridge, and it's kudzu infested. And for whatever reason, I happened to see a deer stick its head up out of the middle of the kudzu. And I told him, I said, "Watch the deer." And about the time I said deer, he didn't hit the deer. The deer come out of the kudzu and hit us. Its head hit right under the window where I was sitting. I watched it. I mean, he run right into the side of the car. Well, as previously discussed, this temper kicked in, and he started cussing in Spanish. Now, I got no idea what he's saying. I know he's mad, and I get tickled. So I am biting my tongue. I am doing everything I can not to laugh, because I figure he's going to kill me, shoot me, do something if I start laughing. So we probably rode about 2 miles, maybe three, and finally I got enough composure to scream at him, and I went, "You ought to be ashamed of yourself." And, buddy, he almost stopped the car. He looked at me and just shut up. He just looked at me, and I said, "Look, man," I said, "that deer's laying back there in the road, hurt." And I said, "You worried about this piece of junk car?" I said, "This car can be fixed." I said, "That deer's laying back there suffering." I said, "Turn this car around. Let's go back." And I said, "I'll take my pistol and shoot that deer and put it out of its misery." And I had no idea he would, but he turned the car around, and we're going back. Now, this has been a matter, since the deer hit us, it's maybe been 5 minutes, maybe, could maybe 10, you know, but in that neighborhood. We get back up there, and, of course, traffic slowed down because the deer was in the middle of the road, but we get up there, and when we got back, some redneck had already killed the deer and was gutting it.
Stripping it.
He was stripping it. He went to cussing again, and it was over for me. I busted out laughing. I was crying. I was laughing so hard. But he, yeah, that was his brand new car the first day he had it.
Well, I'm here to tell you, he hasn't lost any of that Latin fire of his.
A couple years ago,
Bill Bowman and I went and picked up Soto, who was living in Pensacola at that time. And we went to visit Ken Lucas. Well, for those of us that are lucky to be friends with Ken Lucas, and Ken Lucas is one of the world-class rippers of all time, and complete straight face, you'd never know, you don't know whether he's like Bobby's talked about Tom Ernesto, you never know whether he's serious or not. So we're sitting there visiting with Ken, and Ken at that time had an old dog that kind of wandered around his home, and Ken looks at Roberto and says, "Soto, that's the world's smartest dog." Soto said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Ask the dog where the cows are." And Soto just went, "I'm not asking that dog a question. It's just a dog." And he said, "No, I'm serious. Ask the dog where the cows are." So he prodded him, you know, a good 5 minutes. He finally convinced Soto to ask that dog where the cows were. So Soto looked at the dog and said, "Hey, dog, where are the cows?" The dog just looked at him like he was crazy, and Soto boy just said, I told you, you know, I shouldn't have said anything to this dog." And Ken said, "Well, there's no cows around here." And Soto just flipped out. And Ken never cracked a smile. Oh, man.
When he came up with you guys to the Ted Allen show, we're always ribbing him about girlfriends and babies and, you know, Charlie Smith's future granddaughter came in the door, and Charlie told her and put her up to it. So we're all standing over there talking, and she walks up. I didn't know her either. I'd never met her at that time. She walks up, and she goes, "Is your name Roberto Soto?" And he goes, "It might be." She said, "No, really, are you Roberto Soto?" And he went, "Yeah, who wants to know?" She said, "I do." She says, "My mama says you my daddy." And he goes, he looked at her and he went, "Charlie Smith."
was it Smitty that was selling magazines and somebody walked up?
Oh, yeah, it was in Rome. Some woman walked up and went, "Oh, that's Roberto Soto. My granddaughter has a baby by him. Do you know where he is?" Charlie said, "No, we don't ever see him."
Think about that night. Well, you were there that night, Jake, weren't you?
At the
Ted Allen Joe.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Was, you know, Roberto all the way up here kept saying, "Nobody's going to remember me," and all this stuff. And he kind of kept off to himself in the corner and everything. And he got the biggest pop there that night.
Yeah, you know, because people remembered him quite well and hadn't seen him in a long time.
Yeah, he was absolutely thrilled.
He came to church the next day, him and Mac McMurray, and Michael was there. They came to church the next morning before they went back home that day. And he was in the back of the church signing autographs. People there at the church knew who he was.
Wow.
I mean, I don't think he realized how over he was in this territory.
Well, he had a lot of fans.
He did this. Well, guys, we got about 5 minutes, and that was the last name on our list.
Well, yeah, I was thinking about that. If Jerry was on with us tonight, he would say he had to get up early in the morning and it was getting past his bedtime.
Well, actually, Jerry, the reason he's not with us tonight, he was named Officer of the Quarter, and he had to be at the courthouse to accept an award tonight.
Oh, that's great.
And I said, they run out of everybody already.
I think so. That must be a real fine force they got there.
He told me today, he said he was out 4th of July till 2 o'clock in the morning hauling drunks to jail.
Oh, wow.
Jeez.
I said, well.
Good ad for Savannah there. It's not Savannah. Where is it?
Tybee Island.
Oh, Tybee Island.
Now, he's 60. Jerry's, what, 64 now, I think? 64,
something
65?
Like that.
I would hate for him to grab me still.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, jeez. Just, you know.
Absolutely. Well, guys, it's been fun. And we'll get together next week and do this one more time. That'll give me a week to think of something else to talk about.
Yeah, put it out a couple of days in advance so we got a little, you know, you've got so much information in your head there, Mike, that makes us look, even, you know, takes Bobby a little longer to think of it sometime, but he's got some good stories. But you make us look bad when you come up with all this stuff and you've got all the info. You know, I'm kidding.
That's why he does it.
I got to get up. Hey, I couldn't get over when I was in the wrestling business. I got to get over sometime. You know,
well, I've enjoyed tonight. I thought it was a great conversation.
I lay on my back doing this show just like I did in the wrestling business, so I got to get over. Well, it's so glad. I'm glad to be back doing this. And I've said this before, but Jay, you are a welcome addition. Not that Bobby and Jerry weren't great co-hosting, or I don't like the term co-host. They're as much a host of this thing as I am. They just don't push the buttons that I do.
Right.
So, I think one of them volunteered to learn it either.
And you know, that night that we discussed it the first time was, as you said, when we were at Ted Allen's the last Nightmare to Remember event. You asked me if I wanted to be on to do an interview. And then, you know, a few things happened that weren't good for you, but I did do the interview, and so it's been good to, you know, we reminisce sometimes at the little get-togethers with Bobby, but it's been good to, for my little gray cells in the head to think back and remember some of this stuff from those days, and it's been a lot of fun, too.
Because we all remember, you know, this guy and this guy and this guy. A lot of people don't know Roger Howell being a perfect example. I would love to find somebody like Roger or Bobby Garrett or somebody like that to talk to. You know, the guys that were on television every week, that, you know, people just don't remember them.
Right. I did a story on Bobby Garrett for the Wrestling News, and I'd really like to know what happened to him.
He's in Macon, Bobby.
Still is in Macon. And last time I saw, you know, his real name is Fred Garrett. And the last time I saw him, I guess, was at the get-together for that they did for Wrestling 2 there in Macon. And that's been several, several years ago. Matter of fact, I got some pictures of that around here. Michael, Joe Scarpa was there that night. Daryl Cochran was there that night. So that's how many years ago it's been. But, yeah, he came in that night, and we reminisced a good bit. But, yeah, he still lives there in Macon somewhere.
Well, maybe we can round up some of these guys like him, Gerald Beasley, Gerald Finley.
And I don't know what happened to Gerald Finley.
Okay. We'll look and try and see if we can do that. Well, anyway, guys, it's been great, and we'll get together next week, and we'll do it again.
Okay. Yeah,
sounds good. Good night, guys.
Good night, folks.
Good night, everybody.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com for the latest information on upcoming events and more. As always, we thank you for your continued support.